Welcome to Partially Derivative, the show about data, data science, drinking, and awesomeness. Our top 10 data-related articles and blog posts from the past week, all in 30 minutes or sometimes longer, depending on how much we are drinking. As always, links to all stories we discuss today are available on our site, partiallyderivative.com, and on Twitter at @partiallyd. My name is Chris Albin, and with me today is my co-host, Jonathan Morgan. One short announcement before we get started. We will be posting all of our podcasts for the future on SoundCloud as well as on the site. So if you would like to stay with the current setup, that's totally fine. Just, you know, continue with what you're doing. But if you're really interested in using SoundCloud and you love SoundCloud, we are on there as well. So go and check us out. As always, we want your feedback. If you have comments, complaints, cool data stories, shoot us an email at hello@partiallyderivative.com or tweet us at @partiallyd. First things first, beers. Jonathan, what are you drinking today?
I am drinking a greenhouse IPA from the Hops and Grain Brewery. They are based here in Austin, and it is an IPA that punches you in the mouth, my friend. It's delicious, and I'm enjoying it. Chris, what are you drinking?
I am drinking a Point Reyes Porter from the Marin Brewing Company, and as someone who grew up in California and is a San Francisco expat, I have spent a lot of time in Point Reyes, and it makes me miss home. It is a thick, rich, dark beer. Reminds me of fog rolling over the hills, so it is a nice remembrance of home.
Wow. Does it have any, how are the tannins in that beer, Chris? That was a bit,
well, you know,
it reminds me of a thick fog rolling.
I'm telling you, this is a wonderful beer. And also, I don't think there are tannins in beer, although I wouldn't really know.
There's probably not. I was just trying to sound
pretentious. Possibly tannins in beer. All right. We will get started. First story, Jonathan, goes to you.
All right. So staying with really classy discussions about the finer elements in beer and wine, our first story is about data science for unprotected sex. So just in case we're not on the same page, this is a story about the rhythm method, like the actual rhythm method. So the one where you like avoid doing the business during the part of the month when you're most likely to make babies. I like to think of it as like hipster birth control, because you know? It's kind of retro, right? It's like all that's old is cool again, you know, like growing an ironic handlebar mustache, or like keeping chickens, or living in Portland or something. But so this article, though, as reported by Olga Kazan in The Atlantic, there's an app that helps you do the rhythm method properly. I am totally serious. It's called Daisy. And it uses – this is a for real thing. This is patented, by the way. It uses an algorithm that has a name. Its name is Lady Comp. because it computes lady stuff, I guess. I'm not really sure. But in any case, it measures a woman's body temperature and uses that in conjunction with the time of the month, I guess, to determine whether or not the woman is ovulating. And all of this joking aside, I guess this is actually pretty reliable. So I'm going to go ahead and say this is the most practical application of data science ever. Because this is having a real impact on people's lives. To you, Chris, for your thoughts.
You know, this is going to be part of a recurring theme that we have on this podcast about uses of data science that we had never thought about would ever take place. Because when I was getting started in the world of data, I never thought that it would be used to, you know, make a data-assisted rhythm method app, which is so – I mean, it's so cool. I kind of want to know what the Lady Comp algorithm does. So, you know, touche to them for making it. I am so – how does that work? Where did they get the data? Whatever. All right.
Oh, no, they do. They do, because the woman has to like check in every day, or like take her temperature every morning or something. Like there's some input. It's not like you just like keep the phone in your pocket and it does Lady Comp magic.
God, this is so cool. This is the stuff that, you know, I think will really be the future of data science. Not in that we're all going to be switching to the rhythm method, But the uses of data science in areas that we never thought about putting it before, right? As data science grows and it starts to fill in more of the fields, you know, I think 10 years from now, we're going to laugh at the idea that the only people who were using data science were like Target and Walmart and Google or something like that. Data science is invading every aspect of our lives. And it is so cool to sort of see this, you know, like bleeding edge fringe of using data science in this really interesting way. We're going to see more and more of this, and I'm going to point it out every time. Data science is going to be everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is actually, again, like all joking aside, this is a time when I think we're moving away from data science even being a thing that needs a label, or we think about using data to make decisions as if it needed its own process or like special way of thinking, or you know, sort of something outside of our normal everyday decision-making process. It's just going to become like part of the fabric of everything that we do. So, yep, totally with you. It sounds funny, but it is indicative of, you know, the future.
Well, moving on to story number two, which fits perfectly in this. Beyond Data Science, Advancing Data Literacy. This is a story that comes from Leslie Bradshaw from her post that she made on Medium. And Bradshaw argues that while we are in an era of big data, well, I'll say this next part in her words, quote, cult of mathematically included computer science educated data scientists is holding us back from taking full advantage of the wealth of data. And she argues that, you know, if we're really going to maximize the value of data out there, we need to provide contextualization, narration, and design. And what she means by contextualization is exactly what it sounds, providing context to the data, how it's created, who's being not included in the data, and that kind of stuff. By narration, she's talking about presenting the data as a story, what story it is, making it accessible to people, that kind of stuff. And finally, by design, taking, you know, the complexity of the data and making it readily understandable to people. And to do this, she argues that we need to elevate the social sciences and humanities to the level of computer science. So she argues that these fields are being overlooked in favor of the more quant fields, right? Math, stats, computer science, that kind of stuff. And we need to, you know, have a world that she calls called data literacy instead of data science that includes all these different fields if we're really going to have that massive impact. And, you know, I agree with so much of what she has to say. However, you know, I really don't believe the situation is as dire as she makes it out to be. Now, I have a major bias in that I come from quantitative political science. So I've never really felt, you know, that I wasn't on the same level as a mathematician or a statistician. I just had, you know, in addition to all the things they have, I have, you know, a background about the substance data generation process in these fields. But, you know, like when we're talking about this kind of stuff, I think, you know, there is this chance that in the future, we're going to see this data and data science grow. And the problem that she's highlighting, that the data science is currently really quantitative and really, really, really focused on a few fields, is actually going to take care of itself. As data science grows, we're going to see more and more and more areas where a company doesn't have one data science, they have two data scientists, and those skills are become more diverse. So this provides plenty of opportunity for people to join in. I mean, design is a great example of this. You know, a few months ago, I met my first designer who focused specifically on data. So this is a designer that just works on data and how to visualize data and how to present it in a good way. We're going to see so much more of that in the future and so many more, you know, diverse fields coming in and being included in the world of data science. And going back to, you know, exactly what you said before, I think we'll stop thinking about it as like, quote unquote, data science and just thinking about it as, you know, analysis or some kind of research methodology or something like that, that all fields take a role in. And that means designers and storytellers and historians and, you know, substantive fields as, you know, diverse as ever.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's absolutely true. And I think you hit the nail on the head just towards the end there. I think part of what's important to understand in what she's talking about, at least from my opinion, is that in addition to data science being applied outside of these more like strictly quantitative
areas is that people who have a broader understanding of the context in which data science is applied, so people that can really understand why it's important, what the data is saying, what questions it's answering, and sort of what its limitations are, and can really weave that into a larger narrative where you're answering some kind of interesting question. I mean, that's I think where it really starts to get interesting, and it's not so so strictly kind of geek focused, which I think is sort of the point that she's trying to make. And I think that actually is really exciting. And I don't know that those two things are that's necessarily something that's going to happen on its own, unless there is an intentional approach to making sure that people are data literate, that they really understand what the data is saying, and that they can use that to craft a story when they're sharing the insight that they gained from investigating some kind of data set.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that, you know, in the world of working with data, data's been around for a long time, but, you know, the widespread use of data, if you think about that as a field into itself, we are absolutely at its infancy. So, you know, years from now, I think we will all look back and see a very strange picture of what we think data science was compared to what it became. And, you know, I agree with you. I think we're going to see a lot more, you know, other fields come and sort of join the field.
Yeah, absolutely. And this next story is actually about people who are interested in maybe getting involved in that field through the lens of a fairly particular application. So, if you're looking for a fun side project, we're kind of getting towards the holidays and everybody has a little bit of downtime. NASA is offering $35,000, which is, you know, not insignificant, for ideas that make use of climate data to address vulnerabilities faced by the United States in coping with climate change. So if you're based in the U.S., if you're interested in the problem of climate change and you want to dig into it, and I think particularly if you're interested in doing some kind of data science project on the side, maybe to learn a new skill or check out a new technology, you should look into the Climate Resilience Data Challenge, and we'll link to it on the site. You can go see for yourself, see what the rules and regulations are and all that stuff. But it kicked off on December 15th, so a little bit earlier this week, but you actually have until March to submit your idea. So there's plenty of time. Lots of data to work with, lots of interesting questions to solve. And if you come up with something useful, you will be part of something really important, helping NASA, which A, is awesome, and B, is focusing on a really important issue of climate change. And so, you know, in between watching football games and having second helpings of ham and assembling your children's Christmas toys, you can get down to something really cool. Learn how to do something that you didn't know before, and make the world hopefully a slightly better place. So yeah, check it out, NASA's Climate Data Challenge.
Yeah, this actually, I am a big fan of these, although I haven't been a huge participant in them, but you know. For a lot of people, you get this very standard question where they go and they buy some O'Reilly books and they read about data science and they go through the tutorials and that kind of stuff. And then they say, all right, well, what's next, right? I've gone through four or five books. I can do some stuff, but like I don't have a full-time job in doing it, but I'd like to get one. Like where's the bridge between me working on just, you know, going through a tutorial and me actually working on it? This is that bridge. This is that middle ground, in my opinion, where you can sit down and apply yourself in a really interesting, problem. And, you know, for a lot of these competitions, and we're seeing much, much more of them going down in the future, you know, you get a ranking. So you're saying, okay, I'm fifth or I'm first or I'm second or something like that. It's a really cool way to actually learn data science by doing it and by doing it to apply yourself to really interesting challenges, to go beyond just simply using tutorials, but before you're working on it full time, that's all you do in your day. So I definitely recommend people go and do this and other challenges like it to, you know, learn how to work in data science and actually do it in a real setting, as in a real data and a real problem, and trying to tackle something that there is not a solution laid out for you that you're trying to find. It's there is no solution. You are in charge of just, you know, figuring out how it works, which is exactly how data science works.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's probably worth noting also that even if you're not interested in this challenge in particular, or you don't know where to go and look for other similar technical challenges where you might be able to apply some new data science techniques, this is something that people do all the time. There's plenty of government data available. There's plenty of kind of large big data sets. We talked about some of them last week. There's lots of data available from the United Nations and other kind of international governing bodies that may or may not answer all sorts of interesting questions. And it's fairly popular to take some kind of social good question and apply your time when you're learning some of these data science techniques to answering some of these questions. So people do it in academia all the time when they're learning about data science. So instead of going around and maybe figuring out how to better monetize a digital advertising, depending on where it's placed on a page or whatever, you know, kind of the standard corporate applications of data science, which are perfectly acceptable. And a lot of us, you know, make our living doing data science around just these kind of problems. There are a lot of interesting questions to answer and a lot of data that's available. And you will be the point of bringing this up is to note that there's a platform for the answers to those questions. So as you go through and try and solve some of these problems, there's a very interested and receptive audience that will promote the work that you're doing. And so you can not only learn a new skill, but get a little recognition for the work that you're doing as well.
Yeah, it's a great alternative to participating in something like a hackathon where you have to, you know, get up and spend your entire weekend on it. Where it, with something like this, you can actually go and work on it on your own time, let's say after your day job or, you know, in front of the TV or something like that. So I definitely recommend people check it out. All right, next story goes to me. The equation that can help predict zombie migration patterns. And this comes from Mark Strauss from the IO9 blog. It's a sci-fi blog. The post actually talks about research done by an Oxford University mathematician called Thomas Woolley. And in a published paper, this is an awesome title, it's called The Mathematical Modeling of Zombies. Woolley argues that earlier studies of zombie outbreaks, and I just want to highlight that there have been earlier studies of a fictional threat. These earlier studies focused on human interaction with zombies, as in like how many interactions a human would have with a zombie within a given time period and that kind of thing. And to fix this glaring hole in zombie research, Woolley has created a model that actually looked at a zombie outbreak from a spatial perspective, as in taking into account zombies randomly shuffling around the earth, i.e. a random walk, which a lot of people who are familiar with data science would have, you know, a strong familiarity with. And I'll spare you the details of the paper, but it is glorious in its detail and zombie geekiness.
God, flying. I totally went to the wrong university. Like, I should have been at Oxford studying zombie outbreaks. This is amazing.
I mean, I've said it before, and I'll say it again. I have a huge soft spot for this kind of fictional application of quantitative reasoning. And, you know, one of my favorite books is a book by a political scientist called Dan Dresner. And Dan Dresner wrote this book. It's called The Theories of International Politics and Zombies. And it uses zombie outbreaks as an excuse to teach about international relations, which is a topic, while important, but to many people would actually be rather dry. Clearly, I'm not one of them, given that, you know, that's what I did my schooling in. But other people would really not be interested in. So he uses this sort of pretext of zombies to talk about something and teach relatively complicated social and mathematical concepts using zombies. And that's, you know, I really think that that's what Woolley's doing in this paper, maybe not for teaching, but maybe to explore the sort of methodology behind it and that kind of stuff. It's cool. It is absolutely cool. We will link to both the post and the entire paper itself on our site, partiallyderivative.com. So go and check it out. It's great.
Yeah, I think, I mean, on two levels. One, I do think it's – I really love this about zombie literature in general, that there's this kind of – there's always a little bit of a social commentary. Like it's never just – it's not a random scary monster or
whatever, like some disease. It's more of it's great that it's always a commentary about the way that society would respond to this kind of threat, or, you know, kind of indicative of the perils of modern living or whatever it is, right? There's always a kind of social angle in a lot of the zombie stories. But two, I think there's really interesting there are a lot of interesting ways in which we can improve the field of data science, right? New techniques, new approaches to solving problems. And often you read some of these academic papers and they're super dry, a lot like perhaps the the political science book that you were talking about. And especially for somebody, you know, I come from a computer science background. It's not exactly, you know, as if I'm not comfortable with technical material, but I do find some of the, you know, machine learning and data science academic journals to be somewhat tough going. I'll just be honest. So the fact that we were able to explore a new topic using something really accessible like a zombie attack is a really fantastic. I mean, it takes an idea and it makes it really approachable and it makes it fun and interesting to dig into. And I think the people that manage to walk that line it's a real stroke of genius. So I am interested in reading more from Mr. Woolley. I think that he's hit on something really fun.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think we should both read it and then we will be zombie experts when the outbreak occurs.
Which is important. Yeah, that's why I keep a baseball bat under my bed. So when it happens, we'll be prepared. So on a totally unrelated note, I can't even imagine a possible segue to connect the zombie apocalypse and this next story. But this next one is super cool. Actually, you know what? It is a little bit fictional. Like, it's so amazing. It's almost fictional, but it's real. So I can imagine on a podcast about data science that we may have a few Star Trek fans listening to us out there. But just in case you're not, so on Star Trek, it's a TV show and movies and whatever, but the premise is that it's about like space and aliens and stuff, right? So like people travel through space and they meet aliens. And like most sci-fi, somehow all of the intelligent beings in the universe happen to speak English. Because it's impractical to have them speaking lots of different made-up languages. But the point is that like the conceit of the show is that they don't actually speak English. Everyone just uses what they call like a universal translator, which is kind of impossible. Except, and here's the thing, Robert McMillan in Wired is covering a new technology from Skype that is a universal translator. I mean, almost. It's not quite a universal translator yet. It's called the Skype Translator, and they're releasing it to a small group of beta testers. And at the moment, it translates Spanish to English and vice versa in real time. So there's a promotional video in the article, which is like actually kind of inspiring. And I'm sure there's going to be a ton of blog posts about this in the week to come. The technology is just kind of going out. People are just starting to beta test it. It seems to work just like they describe it, where somebody's speaking in Spanish, it's translated voice to voice, like a computer voice translates it into your ear in English, and then you can respond in English, and it translates it back to Spanish for the person you're having the conversation with. This is amazing. On a personal note, I've spent many thousands of hours learning Spanish. And it turns out I may not have needed to, because now in adulthood, technology can translate for me. Nevertheless, this is, it's amazing. Like, it's really jaw-dropping. It feels like the future. So congratulations to Skype. I am super excited. If there's anybody out there who works for Skype or Microsoft or whatever, and can maybe, hit me up with one of those beta tester invites, I am willing and ready.
You know, I will say, as someone who has spent many thousands of hours to learn to speak Spanish very poorly, I am very excited about these types of tools. But, you know, I'll have 2 points on this. First, you really shouldn't go to Star Trek on this. You should go to The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Babelfish. That's the nerd place to go for this thing. But that aside, on a more serious note, you know, these are challenges of data science that a few years ago we wouldn't even begin to be able to approach, right, trying to do live translation, right, huge volumes of data going really fast, big, you know, like let's say it's machine learning, how do you get that data set of all those different words coming in and the pronunciations and even the voice recognition and that kind of stuff in two languages? These are hard, hard data science challenges, and it's cool to see, you know, organizations start to tackle this big part of it. This is awesome. I think we're going to see lots of stuff like this. I think we're going to see lots of stuff that takes, you know, applies data science to audio, to video, and really things that a few years ago we wouldn't touch. This is cool. This is super cool.
Yeah, it really does feel like that's the next wave. Like, we've sort of looked at big data, and for the most part, up until now, it's been mostly about kind of offline batch processing kind of stuff, where the insights were really remarkable because we were never able to investigate data sets of that size. And we're now moving on to where we can do that same level of complex computation and learning, but just in real time, which is – that really does – kind of open up a whole new set of possibilities for the applications of these types of technologies. So let's do it.
Yeah. All right. Next story. Story number 6, finding similar neighborhoods across cities. This comes from a blog post by Gerard Le Fallier, which if I brutalize your name, you know, I apologize for. But the question that he actually attempts to answer in his master's thesis, which is what the blog post is about, is this really, really basic one, but it's so cool. He tries to answer this question of, okay, if there's a neighborhood that I enjoy in one city, let's say the Mission District in San Francisco or something like that, but I'm currently in a different city, what neighborhood in that second city should I visit to get a similar vibe, right? What are the similar neighborhoods between two cities? And to answer this question, he actually compiled a data set of 5 million check-ins, Foursquare check-ins from 340,000 venues around North America and Europe, and used that to figure out which neighborhoods in different cities had similar venues. And this is such a cool thing. So I would buy this app if this was released. I do a lot of travel for work, and so does Jonathan, and I would really like to know when I arrive in Helsinki or Rome or London, what's the neighborhood that's like a neighborhood that I know. I would absolutely buy this. But from a data science perspective, what's so cool about this is actually a project that he's worked on by itself. This is a one-man operation, right? This is a one-man master's thesis to do this kind of analysis. And I love the idea that someone sitting down on their home computer can pull down Foursquare data and come up with something that's so interesting, something that actually provides real value to people. This is, you know, just an individual who's doing this kind of thing. I love this stuff. So, you know, we talked about last week about, you know, how doing these sort of big projects from home, let's say pulling down Twitter data and running analysis on that, in this case, pulling down Foursquare data, running analysis on it, can provide these big insights into big social phenomenons. This is awesome. I would like to see more of this. I kind of wish I was doing more of this kind of stuff. So congrats to him on his master's thesis. It's super cool. And put that app out on the store, and I will definitely spend money on it.
Well, how much, Chris? Like, how much money are we talking about? Like, we should put a dollar on it, and that might encourage Gerard to... yeah. To go through the process of actually putting that on an iPhone.
Gerard, I will spend $5 on your app to know which neighborhood I am in Chicago is like the Mission District in San Francisco, so I can get really good Mexican food.
Right. And meet like the most pretentious people in any given city. Like, that's oh, zing! Right across the bow. No offense, residents of the Mission District in San Francisco.
Shot across the bow from Austin.
Like, I live in Austin. Like, I live in I am in the equivalent of the Mission District in San Francisco, but in Austin. So, like, my mustache just grew like 6 inches based on that comment. So no real judgment. It's all fun and games, San Francisco. All fun and games.
I came to visit you a few weeks ago. I would have loved to know, you know, what was the neighborhood that would be like a neighborhood that I know. I think that's a standard question that people ask. A lot of people – so I lived in Baltimore for 3 years, and people always had that question, like, what neighborhood is like this neighborhood and that kind of stuff. Turns out I should have gone to Foursquare for that.
Yeah. I mean, it turns out there was actually a useful application of Foursquare. Oh, sing again. no, but I do – Actually, what is kind of cool about this, and what I think it kind of indicates, is that the most, I think, for a once you kind of get the lay of the land and you understand the different things that are possible with accessible machine learning techniques, like the things that you can do where you won't actually have to go and write a new algorithm or figure out a different way of approaching a problem. Like, this is a, I think, a classification problem that would be, you know, difficult to accomplish, but at the same time, probably not unapproachable given a standard set of libraries available in your favorite programming language. But what's cool about it is that it's a really interesting question to ask. And that's, I think, what's exciting, is that we're at a point now where the fun part is the creativity in finding the interesting questions to ask, and less about the kind of, you know, grunt work of figuring out how the technologies need to be applied. So I think it's a super cool idea.
Yeah, welcome to the new creative world of small apps using data science. So that's going to be awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. The hipsters have a new playing field. and so speaking of that, well, this is actually a pretty good segue. So story number seven is all about choosing an algorithm for your classification problem. So if you've been in the situation where you know that the machine learning problem that you're focused on falls into the classification bucket, basically, like, you know, slotting things into categories based on a training data set, you've probably thought about which algorithm you should choose to fit your model to the data. And it turns out the answer is always random forest. So I don't care what you're using, the algorithm that you want is random forest. So this actually comes from Jason Brownlee. He on the website Machine Learning Mastery, but it's actually covering a paper that was released in the Journal of Machine Learning Research called "Do We Need Hundreds of Classifiers to Solve Real-World Classification Problems?" Written with a question mark, it asks the question, it poses the question, and the answer is no. So I guess in the paper, the authors evaluated like 179 classifiers using 121 data sets. And my guess would be is that most of you out there, if you do this kind of machine learning, you probably have like a go-to algorithm, like the one that worked whenever you were working on some problem that required classification. You found an algorithm, it worked for you, it was a great model for your data. And that's the one that you use all of the time because that's sort of your go-to. But it turns out that unless that algorithm is random forest or maybe like Gaussian SVM, it's wrong. It's not the best algorithm because most of the time those two or one from those two turn out to be the ones that are the most accurate and the most performant. So, I mean, I should take a step back and say that this is kind of a big statement. And in reality, there's probably not one algorithm to rule them all. The paper's, I think, making generalizing a little bit. And Jason, the author of the article, more or less makes that point. And he advocates for doing something that I think is totally reasonable. And that is spot checking your favorite algorithm with maybe a dozen others as you're doing your analysis. And I think that that's about right, because most of the time, unless you are a mathematician or a very advanced, probably academic computer scientist, the details of each algorithm that you might apply in a machine learning problem are probably not at your fingertips. They're certainly not at mine. And so I think it's reasonable to have one that is more or less your go-to algorithm. If you don't have one, go ahead and pick random forest. But then spot check that against the data that you're testing against to see which one of maybe, you know, 10 or 12 of the most popular algorithms gives you the best fit does the best against your test set. Because I think ultimately that's the that's the most reasonable approach. And it may turn out to be random for us most of the time, but at least you know that you've looked at some options and you found the one that is performant and fits your data.
Yeah, you know, for me, this kind of stuff is actually really useful. So the most useful piece of paper that I ever produced in my PhD program was a guide to which regression model to run based on what you're, you know, what you were looking at. So you have a categorical dependent variable, you should run this. You have like a strong change after a treatment effect, you should run this, that kind of stuff. I think those kind of broad examinations of many, many methods to help people decide which one to use are really useful because they provide people with that high-level landscape view of this kind of stuff. Because it's so easy to get, you know, thrown into the weeds of, okay, well, here's the nuances of this one, and here's the nuances of this other, and that kind of stuff. But to take a step back and say, all right, well, here's a, you know, here's the wide world of analytical methodologies that you could use for this particular problem. Here's some suggestions on which one you could use for this type, and this, you know, this. Here's some ones you could use for this other type, and that kind of stuff. It's useful. I think it makes the world of data science more practical to people who say, okay, well, I have a question. How do I go about answering this? Because I'm not going to sit down and figure out the nuances of 179 classifiers or 10 million different types of regression models.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Because ultimately, you know, like we keep bringing up, I think maybe ad nauseum to some of the listeners, is that we're in a phase where there's a lot of practical, real-world applications of this. I mean, most of the work that I think you and I do, definitely the work that I do, is indicative of that. You don't need to we're looking for sort of straightforward, the shortest path to answering the questions that we have. And if there's a shortcut that gets us most of the way there most of the time, I think that that's actually a totally legitimate approach to a lot of the everyday use cases for machine learning that we have either in our jobs or in our side projects.
Yeah, and you know, it's nice to know that certain classifiers, or let's say, you know, in the case of the document that I produced, regression models work, you know, pretty much as well, right? So if you're really comfortable with a model and it does seem to work as well or very close to as well as something that's much more complicated or something you're not familiar with, you're okay to being like, okay, let's go with the one I know for this particular question. Obviously, that's depending on, you know, the sort of the level of accuracy that you're sort of required to get, right? So certain questions where you're saying, okay, this is super, super important that I am, you know, get absolute highest level of accuracy. Maybe I'll go with the one with more that's more complex. But for a lot of questions, you know, I like the idea that data scientists or other people working with data can choose the model that they want to use based on, you know, how careful they want to be, or let's say, you know, they're running something on the Star Wars data set or the zombie data set or something like that, they might have a much more loose approach to it. And someone who's doing something, let's say with, you know, patient information or drug trials or something like that might be like, okay, I'm going to take the long way around that's, you know, 0.0002% better or something like that. That's a very legitimate approach.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the case where you should really take Jason's advice and make sure that you're investigating thoroughly maybe a handful of models that are, you know, most appropriate for your problem. But yeah, it's great. And if that's not the case for you, if you are just playing around with the Star Wars data set, random forest, my friends.
All right. Next story. Story number 8, a non-comprehensive list of awesome things that people did in 2014. This comes from Jeff Leake of the Bloomberg School of Public Health. But more importantly, it comes from a very famous blog called Simply Stats. So I should point out that Simply Stats is a blog by 3 biostat professors, probably one of the most mainstream statistics biostats R blogs out there. The blog post is...
I don't mean to interrupt, but you just said mainstream biostats R statistics blog. And I just want to...
We're a growing field.
Mainstream of that subset of blogs, which I don't even know what that means. No offense to Simply Stats. I mean, I love it too, but
it's a very well known blog in a small pond. But the post itself is 38 items that people did, you know, various things like, let's say, you know, a really cool blog post or a really interesting paper or a really interesting R package that came out in 2014. It's, you know, it's a huge repository of really interesting stuff. I'll say that it's very R focused, but that's the nature of biostats, that it's really R focused. So if you're looking for some of the best, you know, best data science stuff that's really R focused that came out in the last year, I'd recommend checking it out. I have two things to say on this. First, I feel obligated to mention that Partially Derivative, this podcast, came out in 2014 and is not on the list. So I just want to make sure that everyone mentally appends our launch to the end as the 39th item. But on a more serious note, you know, looking at this list, we really see how dynamic the field of data science is, right? This is not a slow, static field that kind of slogs along at the pace of academia. This is a really, really dynamic field that has, you know, the stuff that we're going to be working with 2 years from now is not the stuff that we were working with 2 years previously, or maybe not even this year. So there's so many interesting things that are happening in the future, and there's so many tools that people are using now that they weren't using before, and so many tools that are about to come out that we're not using now. I think it's a great point to sort of see the year in review and see how fast this field is moving.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, to be fair to us, because that's really the most important thing I'd like to comment on here, we did just start like a month ago. So, I mean, what we'll probably see on next year's list is the ascendance of Partially Derivative as the the most beloved data science podcast on planet Earth. I don't know.
I think it's a good goal. Right. That's a good goal. 2015 set out most beloved podcast amongst biostatisticians.
Using R. Yeah. All right. So you can tell this IPA is a little bit stronger than what I usually drink. Story number nine. So this is a post by Katie Peake in Popular Science, and it's actually just showcasing one visualization. It's a 3D map of the Earth that shows real-time weather patterns. And so I think most of us have probably seen some example of like a spinning globe in JavaScript or something. And this is basically that. But the cool thing about it is it's by a guy called Cameron Baracchio, and the fact that it uses a fairly large data set of real-time information and shows that moving across this globe that you can manipulate with your mouse in the browser is really significant. I mean, I think it shows just how performant both browsers have become and also the libraries that are responsible for most of the interactive visualizations that you see. It's really impressive that we can render that much information and have it move and be manipulated in real time. It's kind of fantastic. And I think it's really part of what's making investigating data sets so common and so normal for people who are increasingly less technical. So the other thing that I'd like to point out here that's pretty fantastic, everybody is familiar with D3, who does data visualization. And just in case that's not your sort of area of focus, D3 stands for data-driven documents. It's a JavaScript library, which is a programming language that's really popular for mostly interacting with web browsers. And people have built all sorts of libraries on top of D3 for basic charts and other kind of interactive visualizations. But I think what's overlooked a lot with this library in particular is that it's the ability to produce geospatial visualizations is really phenomenal. I've done a lot of work with the different sort of capabilities that the library exposes. There's lots of different standard projections that are really easy to work with. It kind of interops really seamlessly with different types of geospatial data. It really is. It makes this kind of work significantly easier than you might expect. So instead of always turning towards Google Maps or OpenStreetMap or Leaflet or some kind of really fully featured mapping framework, if you need to do a really precise visualization and it needs to be geospatially accurate, have a look at D3. There's a lot there, and this is a great example of it. So kudos to Katie for pointing it out, and definitely check out the source code on the page to see how Cameron approached displaying these real-time weather patterns on top of a globe, because it's all there. It's not even minified. You can dig into it yourself and see how it's done.
Yeah, this is very cool. I think the part of this I really liked is exactly the same as yours, that it highlights the power of D3. And you know, people who are interested in getting into D3, I think it's so easy to look at it. It's like, oh, this is a little thing that makes, you know, bar charts and stuff like that in your browser. D3 is incredibly powerful, and it's only going to get more powerful in the coming years. So, you know, I think the depths of what you can do with D3 are huge already, and they're going to get even huger. And, you know, this idea of doing a lot more stuff in the browser and making things a lot more interactive for the users, that's where we're going with this. The world of static plots and static maps, which is where, you know, I sort of started out, is dying in comparison to these really cool dynamic visualizations and maps that sit right in your browser and present you with something that's an interactive way of looking at a set of data. So it is a really interesting map. It's a really powerful use of the D3 library, and I think it's, you know, sort of indicative of what we're going to see more and more.
Absolutely. I totally agree. And if you haven't had a chance to play around with D3 yet, it's a little bit daunting at first. There's a bit of a learning curve. I would advocate giving it a shot over some of the libraries that have been built on top of it. I mean, those are fantastic for kind of, you know, quick and dirty visualizations. But if you really want to understand how the visualization you're creating is being rendered and its interplay, like with the DOM, the representation of the page that the browser uses, I would I'd recommend it. It's a good learning experience, and it'll really help you understand what's happening when you start to work with some of those libraries. Basically, you know, interfaces for making interacting with D3 a little bit more straightforward. You'll get a lot of value out of that, and your visualizations will be more robust and complete.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. Particularly, you were the one who actually introduced me to using D3 through a lot of the visualizations you're coming out. And I think that is excellent advice, that there's this point that you'll hit a wall and you know, keep on pushing through, particularly with the standard you know, D3 set. That's absolutely the way people should do it. All right, final story. Here we go. Number 10, when the art is watching you. This is a story that comes from Ellen Gamerman in the Wall Street Journal. And Gamerman's story is about how museums are taking a page from big companies and using data to track the behavior of visitors. That is, how often they visit, where they tend to go, which art they really are attracted to, which art they avoid a lot. And, you know, the part of it that actually is really interesting to me is not that approach, or that not that angle, but the part of the article that highlights the pushback that museums are getting from privacy advocates that don't want to see this type of big data, big business strategies used in cultural spaces. And, you know, from my point of view, I very probably unsurprisingly to listeners, I tend to fall in the pro-data camp a lot. And I get the argument from privacy advocates that don't want the museum tracking the ins and outs and what art they're looking at. But, I mean, there's two points that I think are sort of worthwhile in saying. First, all the data that's being gathered by these museums is volunteered by the user, as far as I can tell from reading the article. It doesn't seem to me that the users are tracking which Google image searches you're using to figure out which art you like. But the part of it that I think privacy advocates are overlooking is that even though museums are nonprofits, that doesn't mean they don't have salaries to pay, and they pay those salaries by having a product. The experience of visiting the museum is the product that they're selling to people. People pay to walk into the museum and they see stuff. It is absolutely in line with the museum's mission to understand how people are using their product, where they go, what they look at, what they want to see. Do they like this particular art or do they want other arts? Because that can change how they put forward different exhibitions and that kind of stuff and improve their product for visitors. So I applaud museums for taking data on users and allowing users to have some kind of input in what kind of art they show or what kind of exhibitions they show. I think it's going to make a better museum experience for all of us.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. Also, probably unsurprisingly, right? So there's this trade-off between the amount of data that we're willing to give to organizations because we understand the benefit. So there's a trade-off between reduced privacy for increased benefit from some service or product. And people who are very data literate and are very into technology tend to be at the very, very thin edge of the bell curve when it comes to the amount of privacy we're willing to give up. I mean, I'd be happy, frankly, I might have said this before, for organizations to like sift through my credit card purchasing history if it means that I might have novel benefits like sitting next to somebody who's probably going to be interesting in conversation on a long plane flight or something like that. Like making those kind of connections to improve my experience interacting with a product is usually a good enough reason for me to give up a lot of my privacy. But because we're at the edges of the bell curve, I think it's important for those of us working in data to realize that we have to be pretty careful in how, A, we're using people's data, and B, we're communicating the utility. And that second part is probably what the museum isn't doing very well if if their guests are pushing back against them using what seems to me to be fairly innocuous data. Like what anonymous people are looking at in a museum is I don't understand how that really impacts on anybody's privacy. Frankly, it's a public space. But that said, they are getting pushback, and so they're probably not messaging the utility to those museum goers very well.
Yeah, I love the idea of really acknowledging that it is a trade-off between users, or in this case, visitors, providing their data to a product, let's say a museum, and in turn, they get some kind of benefit from it. The article actually talks about people who got perks for providing some data. So if they checked in at a certain number of locations, as in demonstrating that they had visited that part of the museum, they were rewarded like with things like free parking and that kind of stuff. So, you know, I think it's cool. I think it'll make museums better for a lot of us. I think the one issue that could come out is that it can pivot museums to focus on the people who are providing data. So if there's a demographic of people who don't provide data, it could mean that their experience is worse because they're not actually part of the data gathering process, so they're not being measured. That said, there's ways to get around that, and you know, I'd be surprised if they weren't taking that into account. All right, that is it for this week. Come back next week for more data science and awesomeness. Credit for the music that you are probably hearing right now goes to Professor Click. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at PartiallyD and visit us at PartiallyDerivative.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Chris Albin and my co-host on Twitter at Jonathan Morgan. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you all next week.
See you next week.